Position number 21289, wheel 4.
Mr. Holt, wheel 4.
One of the difficulties we found on approaching the Rhine crossing was the fact that the British troops had set up a smoke screen, and so once we got over our target, we had a rather difficulty seeing the ground below us. We were at about 1,500 feet when we got over our target, and this smoke was being blown in that direction, but we could see the ground. One of the other difficulties, that the greatest difficulty that we had, was the fact that we were flying over the German lines, and they had some very good AK guns, which were filling the air with shrapnel. So we found ourselves, I think, in one of the most difficult and dangerous landings that we'd done so far. I myself got to the point where I could see my target quite clearly, which was a field marked in such a way that I knew exactly where it was, because their briefing before this had been absolutely splendid. And I was just turning to put my flaps down and land when I didn't have time to put the flaps down, because I suddenly felt that I'd been hit in the tail area. And I found out I'd been hit in the tail area because the nose of the glider was down in a landing position. And obviously, when you get near the ground, you have to pull the nose up so that you don't hit the ground nose first. But this, the AK had damaged the tail to such an extent, I was not able to pull the nose up. So I hit the ground, not nose first, but nose wheel first. And with such force, I think we must have been doing a plus 80 miles an hour then, that the wheel came right through the cockpit between myself and my second pilot, went up through the roof. And I went out through the windscreen to my right. My second pilot went out through the windscreen to the left. Behind me, I'd been carrying a jeep, a trailer, and six lads from the artillery. And they came out straight through the pilot's cockpit and landed on the ground, ready to take off. The lads themselves had been strapped in, so all they had to do was undo their belts and walk out, onto the truck and the jeep and the trailer. I woke up, and the first thing I saw, 2 or 3 inches away from my nose, was the wheel of the jeep. The officer in charge of the RA lads managed to get me on my feet and asked me where he was. Fortunately, I was able to tell him exactly where he was and show him where he had to get to his unit. And whilst that was happening, there was a lot of bullets flying about from ditches, but from Germans. Fortunately, we were on the other side of the jeeps, and if they aimed at us, they hit the jeep. But behind me was a farm full of Americans, and they were shouting like mad and telling us to run like hell because there were Germans everywhere. So we did. And I and my second pilot, we ran. After we got rid of the RA boys, they peeled off very quickly to get away from the Jerrys. I was able to run across this field and flop down beside the Americans. But once, having got down, I couldn't get up again. And so they got me back to the first aid area, where I'd found I'd injured my knees, ankles, and one or two other places. I was then transported after a day, I think it was, or a few hours or a day, I can't remember, all the way back to Ostend, where I finished up in hospital for 8 weeks.
What kind of treatment did you get there? What kind of treatment did you get?
Well, what had happened is that my legs had been stretched to such an extent that unfortunately nothing broke, but the joints had all been stretched and flopped back together again in the ankles, the knees and the hips. So what they did was just let me lie in bed and massage me virtually every day. They got, it was massage and, but they didn't have to operate, is that what you mean? They didn't have to operate or anything like that. There were no big holes, there were no broken bones. It was funny. I mean, I can still feel them nowadays because the arthritis set in afterwards, you see. But
has the arthritis been a consequence of that?
Oh, it has, yeah. Yeah, that's admitted. Yeah. Yes. It was a question of rest what they were after was to get muscle power to the joints. So, after 8 weeks, I was able to walk. And I and my second pilot had got a bit browned off of being in the hospital, so we told them, can we please go? They said, you shouldn't, but you can if we don't see you go. That sort of attitude. So we did go, and we walked down to the docks, and we found a British destroyer which was going back to England. So we went back on it. I got back on it, went to Dover, went down to the station, asked the RTO, I think that's what we used to call them, the RTO for a ticket to, I'd found out to where the squadron was, because I'd found out where they were. They were on an aerodrome on the border of Wales, whose name I can't remember. But
don't worry about that.
Yeah. And that's what we did, which was all against the rules, and I, as a sergeant major, should have known better. What I should have done was got ourselves back to HQ, but I wanted to get back to my squadron. And when I got back, the major, the officer commanding, quite agreed with me, and I stayed there. I eventually, there were no more reparations after that because the war finished. I left the army. Round about. Somewhere in the summer of 45, I can't remember it now.
How do you feel now about having served with the glider pilot regiment in the Second World War? How do you feel about having served with the glider pilot regiment?
I'm very proud, very proud to have done so. I think it was a fine regiment, and it was manned by fine chaps.
Which of the four operations was the worst for you?
The Rhine crossing.
And the easiest?
D-Day.
Going back to Arnhem, I think there are one or two things that we missed there.
Yes, there were, actually. Really, I didn't say them because they were things that I did. Number one was right at the beginning when we had taken up our positions the night after we'd landed. We'd actually got ourselves, we'd been put to defend a wood, and we dug our slit trench at the edge of the wood as a squadron, and we settled down for the night. There was three or four lads in each slit trench, and of course, being night and being tired, it was taken that two would sleep, or one would sleep and two would look out, etc. So that went on all night, and as dawn broke from our slit trench, we all woke up and we all started looking around and making sure that the Germans weren't shooting at us, etc. And suddenly, in front of us, up pops a German with his hands in the air, making noises which sounded like German in saying, "I want to be taken prisoner." So we did.
Any idea as to why he might have wanted to surrender?
The only reason we could think of, I mean, we asked ourselves this question because the Germans were all over us, that, more or less. Wonder why this chap, and then we looked at him. When we think about it, the poor chap was middle-aged. I don't know how old he was, but he must have been over 50 and round about 55. So all we could think of was the poor old bugger had got fed up with war and wanted to be taken prisoner. Simple as that. And
the other one?
Yeah. And the other thing I didn't mention was the later on, it went on to the 8th, probably 8th or 9th day or something like that. We'd all been pressurised and we're all backing up near our HQ. And I was out with the commanding officer checking on our lads to what they were doing. And as we passed the wood in which I had been, it could be seen a tank, with a flame-throwing tank, coming through the wood pass and coming straight for an anti-tank gun crew. And when we looked, we could see that the anti-tank gun crew had been injured one way or another. And the major said, "Go see what's going on there, Holt." So I went, and what had happened was that the chap who should have pulled the trigger had got shot, and he couldn't do it. So I pulled the trigger, and the tank went down.
What was the morale of the troops like who were trapped in Arnhem?
Now, they were surprisingly good, and I've said this to lots of people, and they don't believe me. But we seemed to take it as a matter of course. I think we'd got used to it. We'd been there for 10 days, and we sort of got used to the fact that where we were and what was going to happen to us. But there was nobody shouting, "Please get me out of this," and there was nobody crying and nobody frightened to death. Not in my area, anyway. Surprisingly, we were fit in mind, but rather weak in body because we hadn't eaten very much in the last 10 days.
Were you hopeful that the Allied troops could break through to you?
We got to the stage when we knew they weren't going to. We were hopeful when we got there that we'd take the bridge and the whole Second Army would be crossing the bridge. But when it after the third or fourth day, it obviously that wasn't going to happen.
Did the Germans call on you to surrender?
Oh, yes. There was one occasion where this fits in between one thing and another. I think that it was we were sent over to assist the paratroops who were defending a wood. That's right. When we got to this, got to these lads, the idea was that we made quite sure that the Germans didn't advance any further. And whilst we were lying on the ground, we hadn't got slit trenches at that time, and hadn't been time. Whilst we were lying on the ground with pointing guns at where we thought the Germans were, because they were hiding in bushes, this voice came over the air. A perfectly good English voice, telling us that we would be much better if we put down our arms and gave in, because they would look after us and be kind to us, but we were on a silly expedition because everybody knew that the bridge could be taken, or things like that. That's what they were saying to us. They were trying to coax us, not tell us, they were trying to coax us into giving ourselves up. And I will not repeat some of the answers that were given by the lads.
Why not?
You stupid German bastard, bugger off! Now you got it. That was the sort of thing that was being said back to them.
Do you think any of them did surrender?
No. 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 Nobody surrendered.
Any Dutch civilians around?
Always. The Dutch civilians were lucky at where we were in Oosterbeek, because every house had a cellar. And what the Dutch people did was retire to the cellars during the whole time we were there. From which, I might say, they supplied us with tea and biscuits, etc., etc.
What about attempts to drop supply to you?
With reference to your question about dropping supplies, it was said right at the beginning that the RAF would follow us with supplies once we'd landed. They didn't start dropping supplies until the third or fourth day because of the 1, 2, 3 days of landing. But when they did start dropping supplies, we'd got to the stage where we were not where we should have been, because we'd been pushed in by the Germans. And over came our Dakotas, etc., dropping supplies, but they were dropping them in the wrong place. They were dropping them on the Germans and not on us. I actually did get, was fortunate enough to retrieve a cylinder which had landed in a field, and I was able to nip across, get the cylinder before anybody saw me. On opening the cylinder, it was full of red berries.
Which was the worst, the hunger or the thirst?
I don't know. Hunger, I think, because we were able to get water. There's no point, no question about that. Yeah, it was hunger.
What was the highest rank of officer that you saw at the time?
What do you mean what I saw?
Whom you came into contact with in the bridgehead.
You mean our own officers?
Yes.
Well, at one time I... Lieutenant Colonel.
From which regiment would he have been?
Glider Pilot Regiment. I met lieutenants and captains and things like that when we were moving from one place to another.